Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We've all seen the pictures of the trapped people on the rooftops, the tangled masses of cars and strollers, boats and backyards, left in the wake of the devil's deluge. What we may not have seen were the mass of chemicals from oil spills, trash dumps, garages, gas stations, and everything in between that mixed into the waters. And now the waters have gone. So where did all the toxic sludge go? We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. This past week, the Natural Resources Defense Council released a report following months of research on the nature of the stuff left behind. The houses, walls, backyards, beaches, and everything that makes up a city like New Orleans. It's a challenge of astonishing consequence for generations to come. This week we're focusing on post-Katrina. Katrina, which was such an extraordinary natural catastrophe that I think we kind of assumed it could never happen here, and it did. Secondly, we assumed somehow that we would be able to deal with this. This is America. And somehow the story seems to be that we're dropping the ball significantly. And there's another side to this story, which is the fact that in the effort to try to do something, perhaps people are being allowed back into New Orleans, and it may not be exactly the right thing to do. But we have to have some science to back this up, some facts, as I keep on hearing. And so joining us now from San Francisco is Dr. Gina Solomon. She is the senior scientist with NRDC, and she's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School. Gina, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a little background on NRDC. We hear these terms, and we kind of know what Natural Resources Defense Council, but what do you really do?
NRDC is a national nonprofit environmental advocacy organization. We go out there and identify threats to the environment and to the people living in the U.S. and around the world, and gather the scientific information that we need to quantify what's going on out there and then get something done about it. And sometimes that means trying to get laws changed. In some cases, it means getting regulations passed. And sometimes it means litigation, if necessary, against polluters or against the government if they're not protecting people.
Yeah, you do things that other people can't just because you have the power to do so, and that's an important part of protecting the public. One of your specializations is public health, very specifically. And so in that regard, you traveled to New Orleans to do some research on the status of particularly the environment that people are now facing heading back into. Why don't you talk about what brought this about, your concerns, and also when you went, and we'll kind of explore how you went about your research to start out with.
Yes, I'd be happy to tell you about it. In the immediate aftermath of the hurricane and flooding in New Orleans, we heard from our members that had been displaced from that area, and also from groups that we had worked with over the years that were based in communities down there working on environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And they asked us to get down there and help them out because they wanted to know if there was a significant health risk from contamination in the floodwaters and the sediments that were left behind as the floodwaters receded. So we went down at the end of September last year for the first time and have gone down a number of times since then to do investigations, including scientific sampling of the air and of the muck that was left behind from the floods.
That was a tremendous concern. I know that I was following and covering that event on the Wildside News, and we heard these tales about the toxic soup that remained following the Katrina event, and that eventually, you know, the waters themselves were filled with all sorts of contaminants. That's one of the aspects of your research. That is to say, then what happened to all of those contaminants? Where did they go? What happened to them? What was the basis of these toxic chemicals? Where did they come from? And then how did this end up making its way into the sediments and the houses and virtually everything there?
When we went down there in late September, we saw evidence of leaking sewage lines, the smell of sewage and all kinds of appalling rotting things, and also hundreds of thousands of flooded, destroyed vehicles, cars, trucks, plus gas stations and industrial facilities that had been flooded out. The result of all of this was raw sewage in the floodwaters that then got spread around in the muck, and a lot of petroleum hydrocarbons, gasoline, diesel exhaust, other industrial chemicals that were spread around in the flooding also. In addition, New Orleans has always had a problem with lead contamination in the soil, and this lead got picked up and moved around from area to area and spread on the surface. So stuff that you know, might have been either in an industrial vat somewhere or under the surface of the grass or bushes was suddenly not only spread across people's front yards, but spread across the inside of people's homes. The kind of contact that people were in when they came back to their homes with this this sort of sludge was very close. You know, people couldn't handle anything without coming in contact with it. And the tests indicated high levels of bacteria from the sewage, high levels of diesel chemicals, such as diesel fuel, and high levels of lead and arsenic. And when we found that out, we were trying to let people know that they needed to protect themselves and also that they needed to be careful, for example, about bringing their kids back into New Orleans until the problem was cleaned up.
Well, now, I haven't had a chance to visit New Orleans since Katrina, so I don't really have a visual on what it might be like to go into a home as a returning resident who goes into their home. What would they actually see? What would it look like? And would they be able to easily identify, for example, the fact that this was radically contaminated?
Oh, Lord, looking in the homes that was flooded was enough to make you cry. First of all, as you approach the door of someone's home, you are hit with a powerful smell of mold. It was choking, and so it was clear that there was a problem. Then when you look in, it really looked like the entire possessions of somebody's life had been put into a blender. Everything had been lifted up by the floodwaters, swirled around, and then dropped willy-nilly with the sofa on top of the television and the children's toys on top of the sofa and everything upside down and sideways, and everything covered with this sort of brownish-gray mud. And then the walls were covered with mold in all different colors, black mold, brown mold, green mold, that was almost hairy. It was fuzzy and growing off the walls. It was just sickening seeing what had happened to people's homes, because people were living there up until, right up until the day that the hurricane hit. And suddenly it was clearly no longer a place that anybody could live.
Well, it's the greatest catastrophe that I have witnessed personally in my lifetime, and it's hard to imagine how people are supposed to cope with this, but they have to. These were so many homes taken out, so many lives that were just so radically changed, and if it was my place, I definitely would want to go back there and salvage what I could and try to rebuild my life, and a lot of people are now currently doing that, and they're faced with this challenge. How does a person go about trying to clean this out? How in the world do you face such a catastrophe?
We saw people going back and encourage them to wear boots and gloves and coveralls over their regular clothing and, of course, respirators to keep from inhaling that mold. And people were sorting painstakingly through their possessions to try to find what they could save, putting them in plastic bags to clean off later, and then having to carry all of their possessions out to the curbside and dump them for trash pickup. And then ultimately these houses that were seriously mold affected had to be gutted completely, all the way down to the studs, because once the mold took hold, there was just no way to stop it. And initially people were trying to just scrub the walls down with bleach because they heard that might work. We went in and did testing after people did that, and we still found sky-high levels of mold, and were able to inform people that it wasn't safe to just wipe down the walls with bleach. They really had to rip out the drywall and start again. The houses didn't have to be torn out completely, but the interior did, unfortunately.
Well, and I've built houses, and I know you start out with the studs, you put on the drywall, but that water would easily contaminate even the studs, so even that had to be a problem.
Yes, people can, with hardwood studs, sand them down a bit and apply, for example, borax, which is, will sort of keep the mold from getting started again.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible to deal with that kind of situation. The drywall, once it's wet, is just like a petri dish for mold, and there's no way to salvage that.
Well, so obviously people are back, and they're busy trying to salvage their lives. Do you think, to some extent, people are perhaps less aware than they ought to be about the dangers that perhaps people are, in the efforts of trying to rebuild their lives, putting themselves in a level of harm's way and subjecting themselves to dangers?
There have been conflicting signals coming out around the contaminants in the sediment. A lot of the government agencies, especially the state of Louisiana, has been putting out the message that the sediment is not seriously contaminated, that it isn't a problem and it doesn't need to be cleaned up. They've actually sort of disregarded their own standards for arsenic, lead, diesel fuel, and other contaminants, and disregarded high levels that at a normally at a hazardous waste site would have triggered an investigation and cleanup. And here this is in people's front yards. So it's been really difficult working with the state and also with some of the federal agencies such as US EPA, because they're just trying to get people to go back and not worry about it. When we talk to some of these government officials behind the scenes, they'll say, oh, well, the contaminants were probably always there. Mm. And so, you know, it may not have been, the lead levels and arsenic levels and diesel fuel levels may not have been safe before the hurricane, and they may not be so safe now, but there's not really any change. That's not an excuse. First of all, things are worse now than they were before. And second of all, things are spread across the surface. This muck is right on top of people's yards. It's right where kids will touch it. And then thirdly, once you know that there's a contamination problem, there's a moral responsibility to deal with it, to clean it up. Even if some of the lead did contaminate the soil of New Orleans before the hurricane, it's not safe for kids. Get it out of there now before people move back in. It's the best time to do the cleanup.
Well, for example, just to put this into perspective, in California here, and around the country, it used to be common if you changed the oil on a vehicle, a car, a truck, you'd take it someplace, you'd dump it on the dirt, you'd find some, you know, backyard area or some other spot, and just dump it. And it became obvious, this is totally illegal now, and there'll be serious fines if anyone were to so much as dump a quart of oil on the ground here, because it gets down into water tables and begins to really destroy things. So it's hard for me to imagine how in the world you could take this toxic sludge that virtually will settle down onto every single square millimeter of ground surface and somehow assume that it hasn't created some sort of dramatic change.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we're not talking about just the quart of oil that you might take out of your car here and that you'd be fined for if you dumped it. We're talking about millions, literally millions of gallons of oil that were spilled from a large refinery, the Murphy Oil Refinery, where there was a major leak, from numerous industrial facilities, gas stations, trucks and cars. And this stuff is now all across the surface of the soil and getting down into the groundwater table, where it's going to bubble along under the houses and then come up when it rains again. So there's a long-term health concern here. The problem, of course, is that we do want New Orleans to be habitable again. We do want people to go back. We want them to go back to a place that's safe.
Talk about some of the specific toxins that you discovered. You don't have to be scientific about their levels because people can do their own research on that. You have those things, some of that information posted on the NRDC site. But talk about the effects that some of these specific toxins could have on people's health.
The kinds of toxins that we encountered vary in their effects quite a bit. For example, in the immediate aftermath of the flooding, when there were really high levels of sewage-related bacteria, people were getting very sick from it. We heard many reports of people with terrible skin infections requiring antibiotic treatment. If people got a cut and it got in contact with the floodwaters, they would get terrible infections. In some cases, people got serious vomiting and diarrhea, gastrointestinal problems, respiratory complaints. And then the other kinds of chemicals that we're talking about, the longer-term contaminants, like arsenic and lead, we're not talking about short-term health effects that will hit people immediately, but rather long-term risks as kids move back into those areas, play, run around, and get in contact with this day in, day out. Arsenic is known to cause cancer in humans. There's no debate about that. And so that's not good for kids living in those communities. Lead, of course, is known to cause neurologic deficits and delays in children. And the diesel fuel contaminants are both possibly cancer-causing and also irritants to the skin and neurologic toxins. And then, of course, I haven't even talked about the mold. But those levels of mold in the air can be very serious.
Let's talk about that, because mold it seems some sort of harmless. It's some sort of little coloration on the walls, and you kind of look at that. But mold, for some people, for many people, quite honestly, it can be very serious in many different ways.
I haven't worked in the past a whole lot on mold, and it's one of those things I've never taken as seriously as I should have. But when I went down to New Orleans the first time in late September, when I walked down the middle of the street, I could smell that characteristic musty sort of smell of an old moldy basement. The whole city smelled like that. And then when I looked into the homes and saw the mold growing on the walls, I thought, oh, dear, there's a real problem here. So I've been working with some of the country's best mold experts over the past few months and have learned an awful lot about this stuff. And it really is hazardous, especially when you start talking about the high, high levels of mold spores in the air that we see in a place like New Orleans.
Are all people affected by some level of mold? And then as well, is there an increasing intolerance amongst certain populations?
It's tough to say what level of mold will hit people. Because there is a lot of variation in sensitivity in the population.
So it varies quite a bit amongst individuals.
Absolutely. Mold is a tricky thing because, if you hit really high levels of mold spores in the air, anybody will eventually develop some symptoms because it catches in your throat, it makes you cough, and you get this sort of irritation in the back of your nose and your sinuses. I'm not particularly sensitive to mold, but after spending time in New Orleans in the flooded areas, even though I was wearing a respirator a lot of the time, I found I was coughing and my nose was running and I was stuffy. Other people who were sensitive were very sick. People can be allergic to mold, just like they're allergic to pollen or dogs or cats or dust mites. And for someone who's allergic to mold, even low levels can cause severe, allergic reactions or asthma attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so asthmatics coming back into the city were very high risk of serious breathing problems. In addition, people who are prone to sinus problems will certainly have, develop a sinus infection and a flare-up of their sinus problems. People who have underlying respiratory disease often get worse in the presence of mold. And then there's the whole set of sort of controversial effects of mold related to the toxins that some kinds of mold produce. And when we measured the molds in New Orleans, we found quite a few that produce so-called mycotoxins or mold toxins.
I know for myself, I didn't know that I was extremely sensitive to certain molds, but I moved to La Jolla, rented a little apartment, and within 2 days, I was so sick that I had no idea. I thought I had the flu, but I could hardly think. It affected my brain, and I've never felt quite so ill in my life. And it turned out that the apartment, which was close to the ocean, we get a little dusting of moisture every morning, and then the sun would come in through the windows and it would catch in the carpets and create a bloom of some sort. And it was extremely difficult. It was a miserable reality for me. So that's one of the reasons I'm concerned about the mold content down there. I have personal experience. It sounds to me, if one were to conclude and do kind of a summary of what we've covered so far, that quite honestly, there's a lot to be said that perhaps people are, well, first of all, they face a daunting challenge to try to figure out how to get back in there. And perhaps in some respects, this is my analysis, this isn't your analysis, but I guess if I were to summarize, I'd say perhaps people are going back a little too early. In other words, there hasn't been enough remediation to the soil and surfaces to allow people to go back there safely. And my concern is that 10 or 15 years from now, we could be hearing some real nightmare stories about the long-term effects of this. But that's just me. Why don't you give your analysis of the situation?
I have to say it makes me nervous to see all the children coming back into New Orleans, especially the young kids who are going to be tending to play in the dirt and then maybe put their hands in their mouths. And also kids are much more susceptible to allergens such as mold. So I do think that it's a little premature to bring kids back into the city, though I know some people don't have much choice. I also think that elderly folks, people with respiratory problems, really should also be careful about going back. I would certainly think twice if I fell into one of those categories. And healthy adults can certainly go back to begin to get their homes and their lives in order if they have proper protective equipment. And a lot of people, fortunately, are wearing appropriate respirators and gloves, et cetera, and I'm glad to see that now when I go down. Some of the areas in the city weren't flooded, and you can go to those areas now, and it almost is like the old days in New Orleans. You wouldn't think that the hurricane ever happened. You then go a few blocks to the areas that were flooded, and unfortunately, they're still devastated, and so it will be some time before the rest of that city is ready to be inhabited again.
What would you, if you could, if you had unlimited funds, and, well, that's ridiculous. You don't have unlimited funds. No one does. That's part of our problem right now. What's a realistic remediation that you feel could accommodate people moving back in some sort of safer fashion? What could actually be done?
The testing so far has identified several significant hotspots for sediment contamination, and then some broader swaths of certain sections of the city that would need some cleanup. The thing that's kind of nice about cleaning things up right now is that there aren't a lot of people living there yet. It is possible still to go through with essentially a bulldozer and take off the top 2 inches, say, or 3 inches of soil or sediment and carry that off. And then replacing it with clean topsoil is actually feasible. In fact, that was done in some experimental projects before Hurricane Katrina for lead remediation, and they scooped soil up from the Bonnet Carey spillway on the Mississippi and brought it into neighborhoods, and it actually did a great job replacing the contaminated soil. So that's doable, and we know the areas that need to be cleaned up. There's no mystery about that. So, you know, the testing's been done. Cleanup needs to happen. The Corps of Engineers needs to do it. Of course, there are a lot of things on their plate right now. The levees need to be done, too. But that's, I think, a very high priority. In terms of mold, that ends up being more of an issue for individual homeowners, where people need to know that they have to gut their homes and, you know, rebuild the interiors. Lots of people are doing it, and I think that that section of the cleanup is well underway.
Well, I think your solution of taking off the top 2 inches of soil seems to be an absolutely, it's a no-brainer. It's that is where the concentration is going to exist. If we wait too long, it'll just keep on penetrating down deeper and deeper into the soils. So that would seem to be the type of thing that people should just should get involved with. Now, in terms of your research and how it's being accepted by people who are controlling the repopulation of and resettlement of New Orleans, how are they responding to what you've discovered?
A lot of folks are responding very well. In fact, community groups are taking this information and running with it. And some are doing incredibly inspiring things. For example, the United Steelworkers of America has partnered with the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, which is a wonderful local group in Louisiana. And they are doing demonstration projects, doing exactly what needs to be done, taking out the topsoil from a swath of a neighborhood in New Orleans East and replacing it with clean topsoil, just to show that this can be done and it works. So there are people out there doing great work. Unfortunately, some of the public agencies have been sending conflicting signals and have been really reluctant to step forward and spend the money that it takes to clean up this problem. And I really think that our commitment to the people of our own country here in New Orleans is a major one, and we really need to make sure that we bring this city back and that we bring it back in a way that's safe for people to both live in and visit.
It's unfortunate that the agencies whose job it is to protect us are living in some cases in radical denial, for whatever reason that is, and it escapes me oftentimes. I think we do have to deal with the facts and the truth, because it actually really matters. Now, if people are heading back to New Orleans and they want to find out information that might help them make decisions about, you know, what to do, what would you recommend they do?
People can definitely go to our website, which is www.nrdc, that as in Natural Resources Defense Council, .org, so nrdc.org. When you get to the front page of the website, there's a search box. Just type in Katrina, and you'll find all of the testing results, neighborhood by neighborhood, district by district, around the city, both for sediment and for air pollution, including mold, so that you can tell what the different neighborhoods are looking like. We're going to be updating the results as we learn more, and we're going to be doing additional testing in the future. Nobody, as far as we know, has really been looking at drinking water yet, and we think that that's an important priority. We haven't looked at it yet either, but that's high on our list.
Well, Dr. Gina Solomon with the NRDC, you're doing some terrific work. The NRDC is always there on our behalf, finding real information and providing useful solutions, and when necessary, coming to the people's defense. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Solomon, for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
At such a time, is it appropriate to dream, to remember a time when visions of mass transit, energy efficiency, green belts, community resources, and just plain community were vital and alive? Yes, now more than ever, we must revision our world to enable us to come to balance between the forces of nature and the human spirit. It just seems
right now that too many other vying forces stand in the way. What's that mean? Time will tell. And as it does, we will bring it all to you each Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth returns. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.